Hello, welcome to this webinar on FIDIC 2017. My name is David Savage and I'm a partner in the construction group at international law firm Charles Russell Speechleys.
And I'm James Doe, partner Herbert Smith Freehills and head of the contentious construction practice in London.
So today we're going to discuss many aspects of the FIDIC suite of contracts and some of the key areas to be aware of when using this suite of contracts. So the key topics for discussion today are: what is FIDIC and where do these contracts come from? What's the structure, procurement routes and risk allocation under the FIDIC forms of contract? What's the right contract for your project in procurement choice terms? We're going to take a look at the key changes incorporated in the 2017 updates to the FIDIC Red, Yellow and Silver books. And we're going to look at claims in some detail, claims and disputes, and the contract drafting that deals with both of those. And those topics are going to be covered by James a little later on in this webinar. I'm going to talk briefly about how design liability is structured under the 2017 forms and make some comments at the end about how these forms have been received as we look back over the last 2 years. So what is FIDIC? Well, FIDIC is the French language acronym for the International Federation of Consulting Engineers. It's an international standards organisation for consulting engineers and construction, but it's best known for the FIDIC suite of contracts. FIDIC started in 1913, and it was formed by three countries: France, Belgium, and Switzerland. The UK didn't join the federation until 1949. FIDIC is headquartered in Switzerland, and it now boasts membership from over 60 different countries. It is a non-profit, self-supporting federation. Because of the broad support it enjoys, the FIDIC standard forms are generally regarded as the leading contracts in international engineering and construction projects. Revenue from its publication of these contracts accounts for more than 25% of FIDIC's income. FIDIC first published a contract, and it was known as the Form of Contract for Works of Civil Engineering Construction, in 1957. As the title indicated, this first contract was aimed at civil engineering sector, and it soon became known by the colour of its cover, and thus the first Red Book was born. This tradition has continued, as FIDIC contracts are known in popular parlance by the colour of their covers, and hence the 1999 suite, which incorporates a number of different colours and different contracts for different procurement routes, is known as the Rainbow Suite of FIDIC contracts. FIDIC's concerted effort at achieving broad consultation and acceptance of its contract forms has seen subsequent editions of its contracts ratified by a number of international bodies. I'm not going to list them today, but just to say that the multilateral development banks are amongst those organisations, and a particular version of the main FIDIC traditional form of procurement, the Red Book, has been developed for use with multilateral development banks. The FIDIC standard forms are used on a wide range of projects internationally, including mining, plant installation, infrastructure and public procurement projects. All FIDIC documents are published in English and, depending upon the need, in other languages as well. FIDIC has granted licenses to various member organisations to publish translations of certain of its forms. In the event of a dispute, however, the English language versions take precedent. Most recently, on the 24th of January this year, FIDIC signed a 10-year translation and publishing licence agreement with the Beijing-based China Machine Press, which will enable FIDIC contracts and other key documents to be translated and published in Chinese. A brief introduction to the FIDIC forms. Over the years, FIDIC has consistently sought to improve on its contracts. The organisation has added new forms of contracts, replaced previous ones, and updated important terms. Moving forward into 1999, FIDIC introduced the new standard forms of contract, which comprised three contracts for major works and three contracts for major works, known as the Red Book, Conditions of Contract for Construction for Building and Engineering Works being designed by the employer; the Yellow Book, Conditions of Contract for Plant and Design Build for Electrical and Mechanical Plant, so effectively the design build version; And then the Silver Book, Conditions of Contract for Engineering, Procurement and Construction, an EPC contract. And also a Green Book, which was a short form version, essentially, of a traditional form of contract. Since 1999, FIDIC has also issued a number of other standard forms, which are also helpfully color-coded. These forms address other methods of contracting, working, and financing. And so, for example, they include the Pink Book, which was the one I referred to a moment ago, approved by the Multilateral Development Banks, which is an MDB, effectively harmonized edition of the traditional form, the Red Book. The Gold Book, a design, build, and operate form. The Blue Book, a dredging and reclamation works form. The White Book, for professional consultant agreements. Subcontracting forms for use with the Red and Pink Book. And an Emerald Book, which is one of the more recent ones, published in 2019, which is for underground works. And then most recently, and slightly confusingly, they have published the Yellow Book Subcontract 2019, but that is for use with the Yellow Book First Edition 1999, not the latest Yellow Book 2017. Now, as many of you will be aware, FIDIC published new editions of the Red, Yellow and Silver Books in December 2017, and we're going to look at those in a little detail in this webinar. So how are FIDIC contracts structured, and what is their approach to risk allocation? Well, one of the main advantages that was realised in the 1999 suite was the use of consistent clause numbering across the major forms for the section, so that if you became familiar with the drafting approach and topic covered by a particular clause in one form of contract, in general terms, you would see that issue dealt with in the equivalent clause number in the other suite of contracts. So you have general provisions at clause one, provisions relating to the employer, employer's administration, and the engineer in clauses 2 to 5, staff, labour, plant, materials and workmanship, clauses 6 to 7, commencement, delays, suspension, tests on completion, employers taken over, defects, liability and tests after completion in clauses 8 to 12, measurement and evaluation, variations and adjustments, clauses 12 to 14, termination, suspension, termination by employer, termination by contractor and suspension entitlements under clauses 15 to 16, risk and responsibility, clause 17, insurance, clause 18 and force majeure, clause 19. So some general features of FIDIC contracts. Although the FIDIC family covers a wide range of contracts, there are some common features. For example, FIDIC contracts are normally divided into two parts. Part 1 consists of the general conditions, and Part 2 consists of the conditions of particular application. Part 1 contains the general terms of the contract, such as issues on rights and obligations of each party, procedure for payment, variation, certification and dispute resolution. Part 2 of the contract is the conditions of particular application and which is used to deal with project-specific clauses such as the language of the contract, choice of law, the name of the person or firm appointed to act as the engineer or employer's representative, and so forth. The appendix usually contains a sample of documents to be used for the procurement processes. In most FIDIC forms, there is a default hierarchy for the documents forming the contract, and the order of priority is as follows. Top of the list is the contract agreement, second is the letter of acceptance, third is the letter of tender, fourth is the part two, particular conditions or conditions of particular application, and then the fifth is the general conditions of contract, and then you have the specifications and drawings and any other documents ranking below those. In terms of risk allocation, FIDIC contracts, like other standards forms of construction contract, seek to pre-allocate responsibilities for risks which may transpire during the project delivery phase between the employer and the contractor, so that where the employer assumes responsibility for a particular risk, the contractor is contractually entitled to an extension of time and or an addition to the contract price. And where responsibility for a particular risk is not allocated to the contractor, the occurrence of that risk would not normally generate an entitlement to additional time or money to complete the works. Standard form construction contracts generally seek to achieve a fair and balanced allocation of risk between employer and contractor, and FIDIC is no different in this respect. Indeed, the balance of risk and responsibilities and allocation of duties and authorities in the 1999 Red and Yellow Books have become widely accepted by employers and contractors as forming a reasonable and fair starting point in allocating risk between the parties, with risk being allocated generally on the principle of which party is best able to handle and manage that risk. My personal view is that that comes out of the kind of organisation that FIDIC is and the kind of people that engineers are. It doesn't stop it, of course, being heavily modified by parties when they actually come to let FIDIC forms, and we'll talk about that later. In terms of the 1999 suite, the big exception to that principle was the Silver Book, being an EPC turnkey contract, which obviously has a risk profile much more heavily weighted in favour of the employer. So within this context, FIDIC has established the following general approach to construction risks, as exemplified by the 1999 Red and Yellow Books and essentially maintained into the 2017 versions of those contracts. The contractor is best suited to deal with risks associated with works planning and execution, provision of labour, materials and construction equipment, and the safety of site operations. The employer assumes the risk of providing the site and any information that he has collected about the site and in ensuring it is available for the contractor to carry out the works. He also carries the risk of any extra cost incurred by the contractor due to the occurrence of unforeseeable risks. Design risks, and we'll say more about this later on, are borne by the party responsible for providing the design. Choosing the right FIDIC contract. Choosing the right contract for the project will assist all parties in ensuring the contract operates in a way that best meets the needs of the project, be it through contract administration, payment mechanisms, or risk allocation. And there are a number of fairly obvious questions to be asking when assessing the best contract to meet the needs of the project and the parties. What is the value, timescale, and nature of the project? There's a specific form that I've already referred to, the Green Book, which is for more modest projects, perhaps where you're looking at sub $1 million US type works. The construction time is short, perhaps less than 6 months. The work is repetitive or simple. The Green Book might be an appropriate choice of contract for such works. But on larger, more complex projects, the key issue or a key issue will be who is undertaking the majority of the design. If the employer is undertaking most of the design, as is the case in many traditional infrastructure projects, then the current Red Book could be the most suitable, which allows for the engineer to administer the contract, monitor the construction works and certify payment, with the employer being kept fully informed and issuing any variations, payment to be made in accordance with the bills of quantities or lump sums for approved work done. But if the contractor is undertaking the majority of the design, i.e. it's a design and build scenario, then the current Yellow Book is likely to be the most suitable. This allows for the engineer to administer the contract together with monitoring the manufacture and direction on site, construction works, certifying payments, with payment to be made according to agreed milestones, generally on a lump sum basis. Who is financing the project? I've made reference to the Pink Book and the multilateral development banks. Does the employer wish to implement a project on a fixed price or turnkey basis, in which case the Silver Book is almost certainly going to come to the fore? That's more appropriate where the employer requires a two-party interface and no engineer, where the employer is not involved in the day-to-day management and progress of the construction works, and is looking for the end result to meet the particular performance criteria that have been specified, and perhaps where the employer is prepared to pay more for the construction of the project in return for the contractor bearing the extra risks associated with a greater certainty of final price and time of delivery. Procurement routes under the different forms. Employers may benefit from utilising FIDIC conditions where potential bidders are from different countries. In such cases, bidders may perceive the use of the familiar FIDIC conditions as increasing the attractiveness of inquiry. This could translate into lower tenders, as the contract risks should be better understood by the bidders. The FIDIC forms can therefore be applied to a wide range of differing engineering and construction projects, from traditional civil engineering to high-tech and heavy-duty oil and gas process plants. In line with FIDIC's overarching principles, they're drafted by engineer, have that balanced risk allocation, and the role of the engineer is critical. So the focus of the FIDIC suite is on the type of procurement and implementation of different procurement strategies rather than the nature of the works themselves. It's important to ensure that the procurement route accords with the appropriate FIDIC form. Now, of course, in reality, and in particular jurisdictions and parts of the world, it has become routine for there to be very heavy amendment of the FIDIC general conditions through the particular conditions. And this is a trend which has received no encouragement from FIDIC, but has become systemic in many parts of the world. And in June 2019, FIDIC launched the first edition of a document known as the FIDIC Golden Principles as a separate publication. These Golden Principles were first published as part of the second edition Red, Yellow and Silver books in December 2017. And they comprise five conceptual principles that FIDIC considers are inviolable and sacrosanct in respect of each form of FIDIC contract for works. While FIDIC has always recognised that the general conditions may need to be modified to take account of local legal requirements, the requirements of any third-party funders or project or sector-specific issues, it has become increasingly concerned that its contracts are being so heavily amended that the final version of the contract bears little resemblance to the standard FIDIC contract on which it was based. I'm going to take you through those principles, but what we have seen in many, many jurisdictions is, for example, a works ministry in a particular country moving away from its own standard form construction contracts, which traditionally may have been very one-sided in favour of the employer against the contractor, announcing a move towards using FIDIC forms and then simply amending those forms back to something which in risk allocation terms looks remarkably similar to the Works Ministry forms that those FIDIC contracts were meant to be replacing. So, the concerns can be summarised as follows. That the end contract doesn't reflect FIDIC's principles of fair and balanced risk allocation, that the use of the reference to FIDIC terms therefore misleads tenderers, and it jeopardises the FIDIC brand. Although the Golden Principles are conceptual in nature, users are strongly recommended to comply with these principles when modifying FIDIC contracts to ensure that they remain within the spirit of FIDIC. Just to briefly run through what those five principles are. Principle one is that the duties, rights, obligations, roles and responsibilities of all the contract participants must be as generally implied by the general conditions. The particular conditions must be drafted clearly and unambiguously. The particular conditions must not change the balance of risk-reward allocation provided for in the general conditions. And that's probably the one that's going to be most difficult in reality to comply with. That all time periods specified in the contract for contract participants to perform their obligations should be of a reasonable duration. And that all formal disputes must be referred to a dispute avoidance adjudication board, a DAAB or a DAB if applicable, for a provisionally binding decision as a condition precedent to arbitration. I'm now going to move on to look at some of the key changes in the 2017 forms before handing over to James, who's going to look at some key changes in the engineer's role and in contract management. So I've given a sort of an overview of the Rainbow Suite, and we now turn to what's been going on in the 2017 editions. 18 years in the making, the 2017 editions of the most utilised forms in the Rainbow Suite, that's the red, yellow and silver books. There was a lot of anticipation around the publication of these contracts. Times have clearly changed significantly since 1999, when the last edition was published. With the financial crisis that unfolded during the last decade, and public and private sector clients seeking better value for money, many projects have moved on to more collaborative project management strategies with integrated project teams and shared responsibilities. FIDIC 99 has remained in constant use throughout that period, albeit, as I have mentioned, often heavily amended. And they're still the most commonly used forms of construction contracts globally. So can FIDIC 2017 live up to its predecessors and maintain its prominence in perhaps a more challenging and perhaps more competitive international standard form marketplace? FIDIC 2017 was unveiled by the FIDIC committee in December 2017 at the 30th anniversary of the FIDIC International Contract Users Conference in London. The initial reaction, it would be fair to say, was one of slight shock as attendees were handed a copy of the 2017 Red Book, with the general conditions alone clocking up to 106 pages compared to the 99 Red Book's 62 pages. For comparison, the JCT standard building contract with quantities, 2016 edition, is 57 pages long, and the NEC 4 core clauses and secondary options run together to around 50 pages. So the level of detail is such that in FIDIC 2017 that the clause dealing with the engineer, that's clause 3.5 in the 99 edition of the Red Book, was 8 lines, but the same provision, which is clause 3.7 in the 2017 edition, now runs to 3 pages. With conference attendees unable to judge a FIDIC book by its cover or a contents page which looked nearly identical to the 1999 edition, save for one extra clause, first impressions were based on size and weight. This was clearly a more comprehensive and prescriptive contract and definitely not one to be left in the drawer. I'm going to refer to the 2017 contracts as the updated contracts. The updated contracts were more prescriptive and required significantly more management than the 99 editions. Contract management, payment and certification. The processes relating to contract management, payment verification and certification and making claims are now newly regulated and structured. This may sound familiar to NEC users as, quote, sound project management principles and proactive risk management are key tenets of NEC procurement philosophy. And of course, NEC is well known in this jurisdiction in the UK, but equally, of course, has been taken up in a number of other jurisdictions around the world and used by large multinational companies such as BAA and GlaxoSmithKline. And it's certainly the case that, in my view, there is a significant element of influence that form of contract, NEC 3 and 4, and its use over the last 20 years and its spread into to some of the marketplaces where FIDIC otherwise was dominant, has influenced the approach to drafting development and the level of prescription that one now sees in the 2017 forms of contract. The stated aims of the updating process were as follows: to achieve clarity and certainty, to enhance the project management tools and mechanisms, and that's where a lot of the additional word count has gone, to reduce the risk of disagreements regarding the interpretation of contract terms, and to increase the probability, therefore, overall of successful projects, with presumably success being defined as projects being completed broadly to time and to price. FIDIC 2017 does not fundamentally alter the risk allocation established by the 99 suite. Indeed, the introductory notes to the second edition of both the Red and Yellow Books comment as follows, and I quote, "They continue FIDIC's fundamental principles of balanced risk sharing while seeking to build on the substantial experience gained from their use over the last 18 years. The standout change in the 2017 form is how prescriptive it is. It now contains several detailed processes and procedures that set out exactly what is expected of the parties and the consequences if they fail to comply. Approximately 50 sub-clauses include these step-by-step processes. Invariably, non-compliance now triggers a consequence, the idea being that the inaction of one party or the engineer does not result in an impasse and stall a project. In some cases, non-compliance triggers a time bar provision. While the new prescriptive approach may help drive a project forward, there is a risk that the contract runs away with the parties unless they are very familiar with all of its terms. This is particularly pertinent in respect of claims and dispute resolution procedures, which James will address later. Certainly, the number of detailed prescriptive processes will impose an increased administrative burden on the parties and the engineer. And some commentators have raised concerns that less experienced users of FIDIC contracts may simply be unable to cope with this. Other commentators have suggested that this may have the unintended effect of shifting more risk onto the contractor and potentially exposing the engineer to greater liability. So in summary, the amendments comprise changes in terminology, formatting and consistency across the suite of contracts, changes designed to improve contract management, clarity and certainty, changes to reflect current industry best practice, reciprocity and user requirements, and enhanced claims provisions with a focus on collaboration between the parties and dispute avoidance. We will consider some of these key changes in the updated contracts and whether these changes are likely to have their intended effect. We have not sought to explain comprehensively all of the changes between the two sets of contracts, but we have selected some examples that illustrate the differences in approach and areas where practitioners should proceed with caution. And we're now going to look at a couple of those areas, and James is going to take us through those.
Thank you, David. So I'm going to be talking about the engineer and the engineer's role in FIDIC contracts, in particular the new 2017 edition. The engineer has always had an important role in FIDIC contracts, and that role continues in the 27 edition. The engineer is appointed by the employer, but is not a party to the contract. Putting it simply, the engineer has a hybrid role, a representative of the employer in some instances, and a quasi-independent decision maker in others. The engineer can issue instructions to the contractor, make determinations regarding claims, and value variations amongst many other contract management roles. FIDIC specifies that the engineer must be suitably qualified with sufficient experience and competence for the role. The engineer must also be fluent in the language of the contract, which reflects the importance of the engineer's role in managing the contract. The engineer must be able to read and understand the contract terms and be able to communicate those with the contractor. The identity of the engineer is set out in the contract data, and that's part of the contract. So if the contractor is concerned about the engineer's qualifications or experience, then that needs to be dealt with before they sign the contract. However, the employer is able to now change the engineer, but only if the contractor does not raise any reasonable objections to that new appointment. A reasonable objection to the new engineer would possibly be not having the requisite experience or competence. If the contractor does have a problem with the new engineer, it has 14 days to raise those objections. Otherwise, it is deemed to have accepted the replacement engineer. I should say that all clause references in the slide deck refer to the Yellow Book 2017. So I mentioned a moment ago that the engineer can issue instructions and is deemed to be acting on behalf of the employer unless otherwise stated in the contract. However, the engineer must act as a skilled professional at all times. And this raises a question about whether the engineer has a certain level of independence separate from the employer. They must always act as a skilled professional. The engineer does have significant power and the contractor must follow their instructions. However, the engineer cannot alter the terms of the contract. And whatever the engineer does, the contractor is not relieved of any of its responsibilities under the contract. An engineer can issue instructions which may, if followed, vary the scope of the work of the contract. However, if that's the case, the contractor is required to notify the engineer if it believes an instruction would result in a change in scope. A failure by the engineer to respond to those notifications means the instruction is invalidated, and the consequence of that would be there would be no variation. As I mentioned a moment ago, for the most part, the engineer is acting on behalf of the employer, but there are exceptions. One of those exceptions is when the engineer is required to make determinations under Clause 3.7. For example, in respect to the validity and value of claims, where there is a disagreement between the parties, the engineer is required to make a determination. In that situation, the engineer is deemed to have not been acted on for the engineer is deemed not to be acting for the employer and is expressly required to act neutrally, and its determination must be a fair determination, taking due regard of all relevant circumstances. So I mentioned a moment ago Clause 3.7. The engineer must act neutrally when making determinations, but it has no but that is not its only obligation in respect of disagreements between the parties. Under Clause 3.7, the engineer must seek to assist the parties in reaching agreement before moving on to making a determination if there cannot be an agreement. The engineer can facilitate a period of consultation between the parties. The contract allows for a 42-day period in order for the parties to try and reach an agreement. If there is no agreement, then the engineer can give a notice of this and then move to seek and make a determination. It has 42 days to do so. It is noteworthy that the consultation and determination process can take up to 84 days. And parties may be frustrated by the delay in getting their disagreements determined by the engineer. This is a far longer process than was originally anticipated under the 99 form. Moving on to contract management. Given the increased focus on strong and effective project management and contract management in the new FIDIC form, there are a number of clauses in the new contract which aim to facilitate efficient contract management. There are a number of mechanisms in the contract which promote and in some instances require compliance with good contract management practices. For example, a notice must be labelled as such and state which provisions of the contract it is issued under. Communications must be sent to the other side and their representatives, and also to the engineer. There are also a number of barring provisions and deeming provisions which activate if one or other party fails to follow certain contract mechanisms, e.g. time limits for making claims, issuing notice of dissatisfaction and other things. There is also a greater emphasis on the contract program. The initial program has to be submitted by the contractor within 28 days of the notice of commencement. Revised programs have to be provided by the contractor whenever the current program no longer reflects actual progress. Provision is not made for automatic updates at regular intervals, but the engineer can notify the contractor that its program is out of date, and the contractor then must submit a revised program within 14 days. These contractor programs must use programming software stated in the employer's requirements, such as Primavera P6, and all activities must be logically linked, showing start and finish dates, float, and the critical path. These arrangements are capable of providing the engineer with a greater transparency and better quality program information, helping them understand the rate of progress of the works and in determining the impact of delay events on the contractor's program. The idea being that this should help avoid disputes further down the track of the project. There is also a provision for advance warnings, and these can be found in Clause 8.4. Clause 8.4 provides that both the employer and the contractor must notify each other of potential adverse events which might impact the work of the personnel, performance of completing the works, an increase in the contract price, or a delay in the execution of the works. This notification relates to known or probable future events, suggesting a requirement to err on the side of caution and still notify if there's only a possibility of adverse effects. It may be difficult to prove default of the advance warning notifications for two reasons. First, there is no time limit by which the advance warning notice has to be given. And secondly, the duty to notify depends on knowledge, which may be difficult to prove, of course. Further, the provisions do not state that the consequences of failure to provide an advance warning notice and that should have been given. Presumably, if there's a failure by the employer to give an advance warning notice, this is a breach of contract and could qualify as an act of prevention for the purposes of the EOT, and the contractor may be able to recover compensation for that. In the case of a contractor, there is no express provision requiring a discount if the contractor could have given an advance warning notice but did not do so. Nevertheless, it would be prudent to issue an advance warning notice in all circumstances where there is the potential for delay or an increase in the contract price. I'll now pass back to David.
Thanks, James. So a key area of any construction contract is, of course, how variations are to be managed. And this is dealt with in Clause 13, which has been substantially updated across the 2017 suite, providing greater detail and clarity as to how variations can be both initiated and the procedures that apply thereafter. The variation process has developed significantly from the 99 version into a much more prescriptive method that now runs to almost two pages of drafting. It does address some of the gaps and issues that users have experienced with the variation provisions in the 99 form. A variation can now be issued in one of two ways. It can be issued by way of an instruction under Clause 13.3.1 or a request for a proposal under Clause 13.3.2. And the detailed procedures to be followed in both instances are set out in those relevant sub-clauses. A variation is defined as any change to the works or the employer's requirements in the yellow and silver books, obviously, which is instructed as a variation under Clause 13. All variations must be formally instructed in writing and state that they are a variation instruction. That's Clauses 1.3 and 3.5. The Red Book also, and additionally, sets out a list of matters that may comprise a variation. That's Clause 13.1. Clause 13.1 also includes new grounds on which the contractor can object to a variation. There are three: that the varied work was unforeseeable, having regard to the scope and nature of the works, as described in the ERs. That it will adversely affect the contractor's ability to comply with its health and safety obligations or those obligations relating to protection of the environment. And finally, that it might adversely affect the contractor's obligations to complete the works so that they are fit for purpose. And as I say, I'll say a little bit about design liability at the end, and obviously that reference applies to the yellow and silver books. Notwithstanding the contractor's objection, the engineer may still confirm the instruction, in which case the contractor must execute the variation. That's 13.1 and 13.3.1. So it's not entirely clear how the contractor's objection is dealt with in these circumstances. Presumably it will constitute a claim under Clause 20.1c. In other words, not a time or money claim, which is then referred back to the engineer for agreement or determination. Variations under the Red Book continue to be valued in accordance with the rates and prices in the bill of quantities, and there are now new provisions in relation to valuing variations under both the yellow and silver books. Variations will be valued in accordance with the schedule of rates and prices included in the contract, and if no such schedule is included, any adjustment to the contract price will be based on the cost plus profit of executing the varied work. Under the 99 suite, a variation could not omit work that was then to be carried out by others. Under the 2017 suite, the parties can agree that work can be omitted by a variation instruction, and the contractor is entitled to recover any wasted costs. To the extent that that omitted work is then carried out by others, the contractor is also entitled to recover loss of profits and any other losses or damages arising as a result of that omission. The contractor is not required to make a claim under clause 20.2 in respect of any entitlement to an extension of time or any adjustment to the contract price as a result of any variation instruction. That's made clear in clauses 8.5a and 13.3.1. There's also some interesting drafting which allows for the revision both upwards and downwards of the performance security relating to the contract where the value of the works by variation has gone up more than 20%, or indeed if the price decreases by more than 20%. So that's, I think, new drafting in the updated 2017 contracts. And there's also some drafting that says that if a variation instruction has a price greater than 10% of the accepted contract amount, or the accumulative total amount of all variations instructed exceeds 30% of the accepted contract amount, then the contractor can request that the employer provide reasonable evidence of the financial arrangements that have been made so that the employer can pay the outstanding balance of the contract price. So what one's seeing here is, I suppose, extended and developed drafting and perhaps more sophisticated drafting dealing with the overall impact and the economic significance of the amount of work that is either introduced into the contract through variation or omitted from it. If the engineer or the employer's representative, in the case of the Silver Book, issues an instruction for a variation, this must be in the form of a notice as newly defined in the updated contracts. The notice must describe itself as a notice and be issued in accordance with subclause 1.3. This is a clear departure from the 1999 contracts that did not require instructions for variations to be in writing. And the intention of this change is presumably to clarify an instruction for a variation has in fact been issued and avoid disputes about the status of particular communications and all those interesting disputes about meeting minutes and so forth. Following the receipt of the instruction for a variation, the contractor must then, within 28 days of that notice, submit certain information to the engineer or the employer's representative, and the change there in the updated contracts is that the information to be provided is more extensive than it was in the 99 suite. Further, the variations procedure also provides an example of one of FIDIC's many new deeming provisions. This instance occurs where the engineer or ER issues the contractor with a notice that is not labelled as a variation, but which the contractor considers, as a matter of fact, is a variation. So in that instance, before commencing that work, the contractor can give a notice back to the engineer ER that it considers that a variation has in fact been instructed with its reasons for adopting that view. If the engineer does not respond within 7 days following that contractor's notice, then they are deemed to have revoked that instruction. So this demonstrates the enhanced contract management role and the point I was trying to make earlier about the contract procedures not allowing work to come to an impasse in terms of the ambiguity that can sometimes be introduced where provisions don't have clear follow-through consequences of the sort that I've just given an example of. Now, we're going to move on to look at a range of issues around the dispute resolution machinery in the contract and the policy approach that FIDIC appears to be adopting in that space. And James is going to take us through claims and disputes.
Thank you, David. So one of the key features of the new FIDIC forms is their approach to the resolution of disagreements between the parties. There is an emphasis on speed and efficiency of resolution, attempting to avoid disagreements becoming formal disputes, that is being referred to arbitration or litigation. FIDIC makes an important distinction between claims on the one hand and disputes on the other, which actually reflect how disagreements between owners and contractors evolve in practice on most projects. Claims are extremely common, if not an inevitable occurrence of any significant construction and engineering project. FIDIC defines claims as a request or assertion by one party to the other party for an entitlement or relief under any clause of these conditions or otherwise in connection with or arising out of the contract or the execution of the work. So a very broad definition. So a claim is a request or assertion of entitlement to claim relief, which in almost all cases will be a claim for an extension of time, which is essentially a relief from liquidated damages for delay, and money, additional costs incurred as a consequence of delay, variations in scope or disruption caused by the employer in some shape or form. A dispute where a disagreement arises over a claim or a collection of claims. FIDIC defines disputes as any situation where one party makes a claim against the other party rejects that claim in whole or in part, and the first party does not acquiesce. So if it's the contractor making a claim, that's the dispute. The FIDIC forms provide an escalating regime. Claims are addressed until a dispute arises. At that point, a different procedure kicks in to deal with the dispute. In the 2017 FIDIC forms, the claims resolution regime is set out in Clause 20. The disputes regime is set out in Clause 21. In keeping with the FIDIC escalating procedures, let's start by examining Clause 20. If a contractor wishes to make a claim, it must give a notice of claim pursuant to Clause 20.2. It is important to note that Clause 20.2 is prescriptive about the notice, what it must contain and when it must be issued. A failure to follow some of these procedures can be fatal to the validity of the claim. I will identify these as we go. This notice must be in writing and would normally be issued to the engineer or the employer's representative if it's the Silver Book. The notice shall include a description of the circumstances giving rise to the claim as soon as possible, but it must be given within 28 days after the claiming party became aware or should have become aware of the event or circumstance giving rise to the claim. Timing is crucial. If the notice is not issued within 28 days, the claiming party shall not be entitled to any additional payment or an extension of time, and the employer shall be discharged from any liability in connection with the event or circumstance giving rise to the claim. That is what is often described as a hard time bar provision. Failure to issue a notice on time and the claim is time barred by the operation of the contract. After receipt of the notice of claim, Clause 20.2 requires that the engineer or employer's representative provide an initial response to the notice. If the engineer considers that the claiming party has failed to comply with the 28-day notice period, then it shall notify the claiming party within 14 days. If the engineer does not notify within this 14-day period, then the notice of claim shall be deemed to be a valid notice. Any disagreement over whether the notice of claim is valid can be referred to the engineer for determination. So there we have two time bars. The contractor, let's assume the contractor is making the claim, must issue its notice within 28 days. If it's out of time, the engineer must then notify within 14 days that it's out of time. Otherwise, the previous delay in issuing the notice will be ignored and the claim will proceed. Now, anyone who's done any construction work will know that construction disputes tend to be factually complex. Having a detailed set of contemporary records is important. Contemporary records are often necessary to substantiate claims. FIDIC have sought to make keeping contemporary records a contractual obligation. Pursuant to Clause 20.2 of the FIDIC form, a contractor shall keep such contemporary records as may be necessary to substantiate its claims. The engineer or the employer's representative must may monitor the contractor's contemporary records and instruct the contractor to keep additional contemporary records if necessary. They may also inspect and review these contemporary records at any time and are entitled to take copies of them. Following the notice and initial response, the contractor is required to provide a fully detailed claim. A fully detailed claim means a submission which includes a detailed description of the events or circumstances giving rise to the claim, a description of the legal basis of the claim. This is particularly important, and I will explain why in a moment. All contemporary records which are relied upon to support the claim, and a detailed supporting particulars of the amount of additional payment required claimed, or EOT, extension of time claimed. The fully detailed claim shall be provided within 84 days of the claiming party becoming aware, or should have becoming aware of the events or circumstances giving rise to the claim. Now, I mentioned a moment ago about the legal basis for claim. There's an important point to note here. A failure to provide a description of the legal basis for the claim means that the notice of claim shall no longer be considered a valid notice. In reality, this means that the claim may be time barred. If no legal basis is given, the engineer has 14 days to notify the contractor. A failure to do so within the time frame means the notice of claim remains valid. This means that the engineer also has notification obligations. A failure to follow these can have significant negative consequences. Any disagreement over whether a notice has been issued in time or not, or otherwise complies with Clause 20.2, should be referred to the engineer for determination. Upon receipt of a valid detailed claim, the engineer is required to consider the claim pursuant to Clause 3.7. We have touched on the various stages of that process, attempts to reach agreement between the parties, followed by determination, if those attempts to agree fail. Pursuant to Clause 3.7, the engineer must act neutrally between the parties and shall not be deemed to act for the employer. I mentioned that a moment ago. The engineer shall consult with the parties in an endeavour to reach agreement within 42 days of receipt of the detailed claim. If no such agreement is reached, then the employer shall proceed to make a determination within 42 days. If the engineer fails to make a determination within 42 days, then the determination shall be deemed to be a rejection of that claim. If either party is dissatisfied with the determination of the engineer, then the dissatisfied party may issue a notice of dissatisfaction, or an NOD, to the other party, and the matter shall become a dispute to be determined in accordance with Clause 21. It's important to remember that if no NOD is given by either party within 28 days of the determination by the engineer, then the determination shall be deemed to have been accepted by both parties and shall be final and binding upon them. Also, any failure to comply with the determination can be referred to arbitration. If the event or circumstances have continuing effect, the full detailed claim shall be considered as an interim claim, but the engineer shall still make a determination within the time set out in Clause 3.7.3. The claiming party shall issue an update to its claim at monthly intervals. Whilst compliance with all of the Clause 20 fails to comply with this or any other clause in relation to the claim, then that failure shall be taken into account to the extent to which the failure has prevented or prejudiced the proper investigation of the claim by the engineer. As I mentioned a moment ago, if a party is unhappy with the determination of the engineer, it must issue a notice of dissatisfaction. Otherwise, the engineer's decision becomes final and binding. Furthermore, the decision must then be referred to the DAAB within 42 days of the NOD, or the NOD will lapse. There is an escalating procedure for the resolution of disputes, and this is set out in Clause 21. FIDIC has a two-tier dispute resolution mechanism. The first tier is the referral of disputes to a Dispute Avoidance Adjudication Board, or DAAB. The DAAB can have two functions. Firstly, it can be used as an advisor as to how a dispute may be resolved without further escalation. The process is flexible in terms of how much assistance and advice can be sought from the DAAB, say that it cannot be sought whilst the engineer is carrying out its role determining claims. The second role of the DAAB is determining disputes itself. For those unfamiliar with dispute adjudication, A DAAB is an entire creation of the contract. It only exists because the parties have agreed to it in Clause 21. It is a relatively short formal process whereby disputes are determined by an independent sole adjudicator or a panel of adjudicators. It is not arbitration. The decisions made by the DAAB are not automatically full and final. Clause 21 sets out how the DAAB shall be constituted. The DAAB shall consist of one or three suitably qualified members. Three is the default. Each party shall appoint a member, with a third being appointed by agreement between the first two members. There is also a mechanism to prevent one party frustrating the process by refusing to appoint their DAAB member. If both parties refuse to appoint a member, then disputes can be referred directly to arbitration. There is flexibility within the FIDIC drafting. DAABs can be standing boards, i.e. available to cover longer periods to address multiple disputes, or ad hoc boards to address specific disputes arising out of a particular point in time. The FIDIC form contains a number of DAA procedural rules, which give the DAAB a set of powers to determine procedure such as meetings, site visits, the nature of submissions and evidence to be presented. There is also a DAA agreement, which gives the parties and the DAAB members are required to sign in order to proceed with the DAAB procedure. The FIDIC draft agreement requires the DAAB member to warrant that they are impartial and independent and have no conflict of interest. Also that they conduct any proceedings fairly, giving each party reasonable opportunity to present their case and respond to the other party's case. If a dispute is referred to a DAAB, it shall issue its decision within 84 days of receiving the reference or such other period as the parties may agree. If the DAAB fails to make a decision within the stipulated time, then either party may issue a notice of dissatisfaction after 28 days of the expiry of that period. Arbitration may be commenced on or after the 28th day after the issue of the NOD. The default under the FIDIC forms is for ICC arbitration. The arbitral tribunal, can open up any determination or decision of the engineer or the DAAB. Also, if a party fails to comply with any decision of the DAAB, then the other party may refer the failure directly to the arbitration. So the key thing to remember about clauses 20 and 21, the claims and dispute resolution mechanisms, is the time bar provisions. These can have very significant negative consequences for the unwary. A party who fails to follow the contract management provisions correctly could lose entitlements to time and money or good defences to such claims. Valid contractor claims for time and money can be lost if they are not complied with. Likewise, employers who have not satisfied the determinations of the engineer, have not followed the determinations of the engineer, can lose the right to have those challenged in arbitration. The key time bar provisions to remember are: the notice of claim, this must be issued within 28 days from the date of knowledge or event or circumstance, or from when that should have been known to the contractor or employer, otherwise the right to claim is lost. The detailed claim, this must be issued within 84 days from the date of knowledge of event or circumstance, or from when such should have been known. In respect to the detailed claim, the key provision and the key requirement is that there is a legal basis for claims stipulated in that detailed claim document. Otherwise, the notice of claim is invalidated, provided the engineer notifies of this within 14 days. It is important to note that this could well render otherwise valid claims time barred, because it may be too late to issue a new notice of claim in time. And the third important thing to note is the notices of dissatisfaction, or NODs. These need to be issued within 28 days of the engineer's determination or the decision of the DAB, otherwise those decisions become final and binding. I'll now hand back to David.
So we've just got two more topics to briefly look at before some closing remarks. And the topic I'm going to deal with is design liability under FIDIC. So there's some interesting and subtle changes here between the 99 forms and the 2017 forms. The design obligations in the updated Red Book have been expanded and will apply to the extent that a contractor is involved in designing any part of the permanent works. That's clause 4.1. Clause 5.1 in the updated Yellow and Silver Books imposes enhanced qualification requirements on designers. So now they must be qualified, experienced and competent in the disciplines of design for which they're responsible, and qualified and entitled to design the works under applicable laws. There is also a fitness for purpose obligation at subclause 4.1. And that's worth dwelling on for a moment because it has developed from the position under the 99 edition. Let's take it under the Yellow Book. The 99 edition of the FIDIC Yellow Book states that, quote, when completed, the works shall be fit for the purposes for which the works are defined in the contract. In contrast, the 2017 edition states, when completed, the works shall be fit for the purposes for which they are intended, as defined in the employer's requirements, or where no purposes are so defined and described, fit for their ordinary purpose or purposes. So this now requires the works to be fit for the purpose as defined in the employer's requirements rather than the contract, capital C. If there is no purpose specified, the works must be fit only for their ordinary purpose. So this whole area will require very careful drafting from employers if they have particular specifications to be met. Employers should ensure that the purpose of and requirements for the works are described as precisely as possible, including for the lifetime of the works and in relation to any maintenance requirements or purposes of the works. Several provisions in the 2017 suite expressly refer to a matter being set out in the ERs, the employer's requirements, whereas the 99 suite simply referred to the matter being set out in the contract. Employers and their advisors should make sure that all matters that are stated to be included in the ERs are expressly set out there. Otherwise, the contractor may be relieved of responsibility for any such matter. The guidance notes helpfully set out a list of provisions that refer to matters of information being included in the ERs. In this area, it's also worth noting that the fitness for purpose obligation is now backed by an indemnity, albeit one that is capped. And that is a good point to hand back for the last time to James, who's going to talk about limitations of liability under FIDIC.
The FIDIC forms contain a relatively comprehensive list of limitation of liability provisions. The limitations cover type of loss and amount of loss. So addressing the type of loss that can or cannot be recovered, there can be no recovery of loss of profit or indirect or consequential loss, save for a number of caveats. These are listed on the slide, but the key caveats to remember are there can be recovery of loss of profit, indirect or consequential loss, if it's embedded within agreed liquidated damages for delay. Costs and any lost profit upon termination and in respect of the indemnity liability provisions. Those things are carved out from the general limitation of liability for loss of profit, indirect or consequential loss. There is also an overall liability cap, which is normally expressed as a percentage of the overall contract price. Again, this is subject to caveats, the same caveats as before. Also, the most important issue here is whether what is included in the overall liability cap. FIDIC includes delay damages within the overall liability cap. It is important to consider this when agreeing the overall liability, limit of liability, so that it reflects both parties' overall appetite for downside risk. I'll now pass back to David.
So, where are we now? Well, as we've seen in this webinar, the updated FIDIC contracts are extensive and thorough. It remains to be seen whether parties will enthusiastically take to these contracts or instead remain with the more familiar tried and tested 99 versions for their projects, or perhaps create something of a hybrid without importing the full word count of the 2017 editions. My own experience, which I think is consistent with other partners working with these forms, is that to date there has been limited take up of the 2017 forms and some concern about the total word count and level of prescription represented by the change between the 99 and 2017 forms, which is potentially acting as an inhibitor to their adoption. Some people have slightly unkindly nicknamed the 2017 suite as the 3 kilogram suite. Many have expressed the view that FIDIC 2017 was not quite the contract that they were expecting. Certainly when NEC published NEC 4, it was most definitely an evolution of NEC 3, whereas perhaps FIDIC 2017 represents a more radical development from 99. It's clearly borrowed some features from the NEC, such as early warning. There are a number of provisions that the parties will need to take care around when amending the contract and in contract management terms, particularly the additional time bars and deeming provisions and the points around claims and determinations that we've looked at. While many of the amendments have been seen as welcome developments, particularly those that seek to clarify clauses that had caused uncertainty in FIDIC 99 or bring FIDIC generally in line with current developments and user feedback, the risk is that this may be too far a departure from what a number of users are used to. You know, we still have people using the 1987 and 1988 editions of the FIDIC Red Book in certain jurisdictions. You know, these are big jumps when you look at the development between those editions and 99 and now between 99 and 2017. Perhaps such a long gap of nearly 20 years between editions may itself act as an inhibitor to rapid adoption of new forms. The risk for FIDIC is that whilst FIDIC 99 was seen as an accessible contract form, particularly in some developing countries, the introduction with the introduction of the NDB version of the Red Book, FIDIC 2017 may be seen as too complicated and too difficult to amend. It may also be challenging for some users with less experience in project management and contract administration, and for those who are perhaps not native English speakers. It remains to be seen whether they will develop an NDB version of the FIDIC 2017 Red Book or continue with the existing Pink Book. But clearly the view that's taken in that area will influence the uptake of FIDIC 2017 in many Africa jurisdictions and countries. Looking to the future, there's been discussion around whether there should be a new edition of the Green Book, perhaps erring more towards Red Book Light, but extending the range of the Green Book for lower value or less complex projects, although some may, of course, say that the answer to that is to simply stick with the 99 Red Book for those sorts of projects. Well, we hope you've enjoyed joining us today for this live webinar. I have some thank yous and reminders to read out on behalf of LexisNexis. This webinar is designed to help solicitors meet requirements A2, for maintaining competence and legal knowledge, and A4, draw on detailed knowledge and understanding of the SRA's Statement of Solicitor Competence. You may also use the quiz, which can be accessed via the Take a Quiz link on the webinar details page to reinforce your understanding of the webinar content. You should answer 7 of the 10 questions correctly and will have 2 attempts at the quiz. Please submit any feedback on this webinar via the survey screen. This webinar will be archived immediately and will be available to view on demand for the next 24 months. Finally, a transcript of this webinar can be made available on request. Thank you very much for joining us today.